From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. We need it. I'm glad we're together. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, November 22nd is the Christian Feast of Christ the King on Tuesday. Sikhs commemorate the martyrdom of Guru Tegh Bahadur, as well as the birthday of Guru Nanak Dev Sahib on Wednesday. And Thursday is the Baha'i Day of the Covenant and also the interfaith celebration of Thanksgiving in the United States. What a week. What a busy week it has been at the intersection of religion, government, and politics, with one topic dominating the public conversation, terrorism. It's been a dangerous week at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. In the aftermath of deadly terror attacks in Paris earlier this month, a shocking number of American governors, presidential candidates, and other leaders have demanded an immediate halt to allowing certain kinds of refugees into the United States. Some don't want Syrians. Others blatantly object to non-Christians. These fear-mongering arguments are coming primarily, but not exclusively, from the political right. And simply put, they are utter betrayals of what this country stands for. A remarkable number of faith-based refugee organizations are pushing back, but fear is a powerful weapon, especially when deployed without conscience and without shame. Of course, a number of Muslim organizations have once again had to denounce terror that far too many conflate with their religion. And in this age of social media, one of the more dangerous phenomena is the breathtaking way that misinformation can spread virally and be unquestioningly accepted as truth. Just one example. A video claiming to show British Muslims celebrating the Paris bombings has been seen by at least 500,000 people on Facebook. How many of those viewers will ever know that it was all an inflammatory lie? The video actually shows a celebration of a victory in the sport of cricket in 2009. But those bent on feeding fear and division will always have an enormous advantage. We tend to believe whatever reinforces our existing beliefs. That's what we've been seeing all week. All week long, and that's what we'll go beyond on this week's show as we focus on facts, not blind fear.
We're prepared to change rules of engagement.
It's them or us.
Now, you want to put before Congress,
yes,
a motion that declares war,
yes,
on ISIS.
We've got plenty of political figures and talking heads in this country that never miss an opportunity to agitate for more war. And not surprisingly, they were out in full force this past week, with mainstream media giving their position wall-to-wall coverage. In truth, there are compelling arguments against a purely military response from both a moral and a strategic perspective. Articulating them in his Religion Dispatches article headlined "Why ISIS War Would Make Paris Attacks a Success" is Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer. And he'll be back with us on this week's State of Belief.
I say it this way. We better wake up and smell the falafel.
Nobody wants to shut down religious institutions or anything, but we're going to have no choice. There's absolutely no choice.
In the aftermath of the Paris attacks, American Muslims have faced even more hostility and hatred than was already the depressing norm. As tough as interfaith cooperation is in this environment, what about doing that work at the latest ground zero? Later in the hour, you'll meet the young founder of the leading interfaith organization in France, Coexisters Samuel Grabowski. I'll also have a few thoughts of my own to share about the current sad state of affairs and our public rhetoric surrounding fear and hate. What some consider to be evidence that, to borrow a phrase, the terrorists have already won. But first,
the percentage of Americans who say our best days are ahead of us has dropped overall. 2012, we had 54% saying our best days were ahead of us. That number's down below majority at 49% today.
This week, the Public Religion Research Institute released the findings of the wide-ranging 2015 American Values Survey. It's an invaluable look at where things stand, and its annual nature offers great insights into trends and important changes inside the numbers. I'm very pleased to welcome PRRI founding CEO, Dr. Robert P. Jones, back to State of Belief Radio. Robbie, it's been too long. Welcome back.
Thanks. I'm glad to be back.
So the good news is the survey headline is anxiety, nostalgia, and mistrust. Why so gloomy?
Yeah, you know, there's not a lot of good news in this survey. So this is our sixth annual American Values Survey. It's interviews with over 2,600 Americans, and what they basically tell us is that it is pretty gloomy, whether we're talking about economics, whether we're talking about their sense of the direction of the country, their own future prospects. Americans are pretty anxious. They're pretty mistrustful, and particularly for many white Americans, they're looking back at, you know, a kind of presumed golden age of the 1950s and feeling like that might be a better time to go back to than the one they're in.
One of the most eye-catching patterns seems to be the divergence among different groups in their perspectives. I'm thinking of how much more negativity we see from the Tea Party as they view the future than anybody else, and how much more negatively black Americans view the criminal justice system than white Americans. How stark are these contrasts, Robbie?
Well, you know, it is, I think, a troubling thing from, you know, the standpoint of a healthy democratic society, that we're both seeing very large racial gaps, particularly between white, non-Hispanic Americans and African-Americans, and also, you know, these partisan divides are just, you know, large and getting larger. And, you know, and these two things are related. I mean, that we have, you know, the Republican Party is predominantly white. The Democratic Party is very, very diverse, and so minority views kind of weigh in there. So these two things are very related. But, you know, these gaps we're talking about are 20, 30, 40, on some questions even 50 percentage points. So they're very, very large.
So are overall trends really that negative, or is it just certain populations that are kind of dragging the rest of the statistics in their direction?
Well, it's a little of both. You know, so, you know, on the one hand, we're finding even among all Americans, if you ask very specific questions, you know, even about kind of things on the ground, so not just kind of up in the sky, how are things in Washington, but really asking people, how are things in their own communities? We have seen an uptick in Americans overall reporting an increase that crime is a major problem in their community, that racial tensions are a problem in their community. And I think maybe one of the single most telling statistics in the whole survey is that more than 7 in 10 Americans, 72%, say that they feel that they believe the country is still in a recession. And we've been asking that question since 2012, and the numbers are essentially unchanged. And that's despite the fact that, you know, a lot of economists are telling us that we're no longer in a recession, that things are better, but it's not getting down to the ground. It's not trickling down into people's everyday lives.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the negativity that we see in these figures is really from the contrast with a better day, or is it just as they look around and see how they're living and what their struggles are, they'd say it whether they even remembered a better day?
That may be true. I mean, we certainly see, you know, less pessimism among younger Americans than we do among older Americans, but it's still not a, you know, rosy picture. I think younger Americans are still having trouble finding jobs. So when they get out of college, they are carrying a lot of debt. So I think it's tougher, and, you know, this generation looks back at their parents' generation and is concerned that their lives aren't going to follow the American dream story of, you know, every generation taking a step up the ladder. Just one number here. We asked this general question, do you think America's best days are ahead of us or behind us? So 3 years ago in 2012, when we asked that, a majority of Americans, not a big majority, but a majority, 54%, said that they thought America's best days were ahead. Only 38% said that they thought America's best days were behind us. Today, the public is evenly split. 49% say best days ahead of us. 49% say best days are behind us. And again, big, big partisan splits on this question. No one more pessimistic than the Tea Party. Two-thirds of the Tea Party saying America's best days are behind us, but also 6 in 10 Republicans saying America's best days are behind us, and Democrats are just a mirror image with 6 in 10 saying our best days are ahead of us.
Huh. What else stands out for you when you look at these findings carefully?
Yeah, you know, the other thing that sticks out to me is the racial divisions, and particularly, you know, in the wake of Ferguson, killing of Michael Brown, Baltimore, that we have seen a number of incidents of killings of unarmed African-American men by police. So we asked a question about, do you think recent killings of African-American men by police are isolated incidents? Are they part of a broader pattern of how police treat African-Americans? Here again, we see very, very large divides along racial lines. So 81% of African-Americans say these killings are part of a broader pattern of how police treat African-Americans. But when you ask white Americans, two-thirds of white Americans say they're isolated incidents. And, you know, it's interesting that we see, you know, these patterns going down. And if you look even at religious groups on these questions, they don't look much different. I mean, the religious groups fall out basically by race, with, like, white evangelical Protestants, more than two-thirds saying these things are isolated incidents. Even white mainline Protestants, which, you know, come from a tradition that had a strong tradition of supporting the civil rights movement, they really don't look much different than white evangelical Protestants on this question. So race is really trumping kind of religion and even kind of history here. What I think to set this up to think about is, with terms of something like racial reconciliation, and a lot of churches are trying to have these conversations, but the kind of biggest barrier is that white and black Americans don't even perceive the same problem to exist. So it's very hard to get to talking about solutions when you can't even agree on a problem.
Hmm. If you have a way of showing me it's not as bad as I'm taking it to be, this would be a really good time to tell me that. Because I see disturbing growth in the percentages of Americans across the board who just don't trust each other if the other person is different.
Certainly big mistrust in institutions, not a lot of trust in the media, not a lot of trust in the government, certainly not a lot of trust in big corporations. But there are a few places in the survey where we are seeing some unity that cuts even across party lines, ideological lines, and even racial lines. And where that is really what I would call around populist economic policies. So one big picture question, for example, concerns about people having equal opportunity have ticked up by 10 percentage points just over the last year. So a year ago, 55% of the country said they agreed that one of the biggest problems in the country is that we don't give everyone an equal chance in life. That number's up to 65% today. And where that has led to is, I think, some bipartisan agreement on some really basic issues, such as the minimum wage. If we ask about raising the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour, there is overwhelming support. 76% of Americans agree with that statement, including 60% of Republicans and 91% of Democrats. So this is a bipartisan issue. And also we ask about really basic family-friendly work policies, like should businesses be required to provide paid sick days? Should businesses be required to provide paid parental leave for the birth or adoption of a child? More than 8 in 10 Americans agree with those statements. So there are some places that would actually address the economic anxiety that exists in the country that would be, you know, bridging issues across the partisan divide. I mean, those issues are out there. We're heading into the presidential election year, and the first campaigns that really realize this is a place where we can build some bridges, I think will really have some traction.
Hmm. There is an increase in the number of people who consider Islam incompatible with American values. And sadly, That number is up, but my question is, why do you think so many more evangelical Christians, for example, think that as opposed to, say, Catholics and especially the religiously unaffiliated?
So we were out of the field far, you know, ahead of the attacks in Paris, but we are nonetheless showing over the past few years an uptick in concerns about terrorism. So, in fact, terrorism in this last survey was tied with jobs and unemployment and health care as the number one critical issue that people said were critical. Mm-hmm. And among Republicans, terrorism is by far the number one issue. 79% of Republicans say it's a critical issue to them personally, and that's way out ahead of jobs and unemployment, which is usually topping the list. So even before the Paris attacks, particularly Republicans, mm-hmm. I think were primed to have terrorism concerns be at the top of their agenda. I think it's why we've seen the kind of Republican presidential candidates kind of leaping on this issue and tying together the refugee crisis and terrorism. Mm-hmm. And we've also seen this uptick in the last couple of years, this question we had about whether the values of Islam are at odds with American values and way of life. We've been asking that question since 2011. Typically, the country is evenly divided on that question. Mm-hmm. And for the very first time this year, we're seeing 56% of Americans, so a majority, agreeing with that statement. And as you said, the group that really stands out are white evangelical Protestants, among whom 73% agree with this statement. So I think part of it is partisanship. You've got to remember that white evangelical Protestants are overwhelmingly Republican and are taking their cues, I think, in many ways from the Republican candidates. I also think we have historically seen the biggest antipathy between white evangelical Protestants and their attitudes toward Muslims. And really, no matter whether we ask a question about Muslims in general, about Islam, white evangelical Protestants have historically had the greatest antipathy. And I think part of it comes from a very conservative foreign policy. Part of it is religious and seeing a kind of clash of civilizations model between the two religions that I think is less operative among Catholics and mainline Protestants. And then part of it is partisanship, but they all move in the same direction to push evangelical Protestants into this territory.
This is the sixth annual PRRI American Values Survey. All of them have had good news and bad news in them. I've got to ask you, are the negative trends that you found this year as bad as they've ever been, or is that just a short memory on my part?
No, I think you're right. There are very few things that we looked at, I think, that pointed in a more optimistic direction. Almost all the economic indicators, the kind of concerns about, like, just one more example of that, you know, just even kind of basic measures of tolerance. A couple of years ago, we asked about people, whether it bothered them when they came into contact with immigrants who spoke little or no English. Only 40% of Americans said that that bothered them. And today, that's up 8 points, so to 48%. So all the measures that we're measuring in this are going in that direction. I think the one place, again, that may be happening is that economic concerns may be, even though they're moving in a more negative direction, and it may actually be leading Americans to cross party lines and to come to some kind of practical solutions like raising the minimum wage or more family-friendly workplace policies. These are the kind of basic kitchen table issues. So if there's a kind of silver lining here, it may be that in the wake of these kind of economic pressures, Americans may be willing to kind of come together to work for some really practical solutions.
The 2015 American Values Survey has just been released by the Public Religion Research Institute. Go see for yourself. Go to publicreligion.org. Dr. Robert P. Jones is founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. Robbie, again, this is great work, and as always, we thank you for the hard work you do and for taking the time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thanks, Weld. I'm always happy to be here. I always end up learning something myself from these conversations.
Why ISIS war would make Paris attacks a success. It's a compelling headline, and the accompanying Religion Dispatches magazine article is no less compelling. That's why I'm happy to welcome the author, Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer, back to State of Belief Radio. Dr. Juergensmeyer, thanks for being with us again.
Well, thank you very much for asking me. I look forward to the discussion.
You're asking the why question. Why would ISIS attack Paris? Where did that question take you?
Why ISIS, which is so weak right now, would undertake an act like this in Paris? Because after all, it's been under siege. They've lost territory. The town of Sinjar just fell to the Kurds. And that's the main connection between Raqqa and Mosul, ISIS's largest city. Thousands of their volunteers are fleeing. They're leaving ISIS and going back home. And two of the main volunteers, the beheaders, they were just killed this last week. So you wonder why ISIS would undertake this show of power. And then I realized, well, that's exactly the point. It's because they're desperate, because they're weak, that they need a victory. They need something to kind of lure the volunteers back to show that they're still on game, that they still have their old ISIS power and spirit. So with eight guys, that's all it took, just eight guys, to create this kind of monumental impression of power that then once again puts ISIS at the center of the stage, gets the Western world riled up against them, and France to proclaim that there's kind of a global war against ISIS. This is a wonderful publicity for the group.
So then, in fact, Mark, the kind of military response we've already seen from France is, in fact, the West playing into the hands of ISIS.
Exactly what they wanted. You can see that the leaders in Raqqa saying, we did it, and they're kind of giving each other high fives with the idea that they are now getting this kind of attention, this kind of prominence. And if they could get France and the West in general to be involved in a ground war in Syria and Western Iraq, that would be even better because they know that that's a war they could possibly win. A war from above, from airplanes, they can't win that. They don't have airplanes. But a war on the ground, especially when they have the population of Western Iraq and Eastern Syria on their side, as disaffected Sunni Arabs are at least passively supporting ISIS, they know that this is a ground war, something that they could win.
So what about the way the Syrian refugee crisis is likely to be affected by the Paris tragedy? How does that help ISIS?
Well, ISIS hates the refugees. It gives them a bad image that people are not willingly wanting to stay in Syria and Iraq and be a part of the great new Islamic caliphate that they've been advertising. So it's a great embarrassment for them to have all these refugees fleeing. So to have one of these bombers be identified with the refugees, and I don't think that's by coincidence that his passport was found right near the act. I mean, who would carry a passport with them to a suicide bombing unless you want people to know that you were a part of this connection, that you were a part of this Syrian refugee movement, which gives the Syrian refugees a bad name. So to the degree to which people now are turning against the Syrian refugees and accusing them, the poor victims of ISIS, as possibly being complicit with ISIS, this is a huge victory for ISIS.
Well, several prominent political leaders have called for only Christian refugees to be admitted into the United States. Now, how does that kind of rhetoric play into the situation we're talking about?
First of all, what a heartless kind of position to take when you have people who are so abused and are desperate and are fleeing the ravages of ISIS-held territory to then want to discriminate among religious groups. And that's, first of all, a heartless position. But moreover, it plays very well into the ISIS narrative that the West hates Muslims and they're only concerned about Christians. They want to say, oh, why are you stupid people fleeing from Syria and Iraq? They don't want you anyway. You should stay here and help create the glorious caliphate. So inadvertently, these governors and other political people in the United States who are wanting to question the Syrian refugees and wanting to discriminate and choose Christians over Muslims, this is very much playing into ISIS hands.
In a sense, it may be too late, but would you talk about what kind of response would be more effective than just military action and demonizing refugees?
Well, the thing that will make a difference, the only thing that will make a difference in Iraq and Syria is to get the Sunni Arabs in those areas to turn against ISIS. Because most of the people who actually live in those regions don't want a terrorist government to be controlling. They don't want a government run by beheadings and the kind of cruelty and extremism and the rigidity of ISIS. they've turned against us once before during the Awakening Movement in 2008 in Iraq, and they would eagerly do that again if there was a role for Sunni Arabs in Damascus and the Baghdad governments. And so the political settlement, that is, to have a change in Iraq and Syria in a way that would allow for participation of the Sunni Arabs, give them dignity, give them respect, make them something less than second-class citizens, and give them a part of the public life in those two countries, that would really change the picture, and that would pull support out of ISIS, and the movement would fall like a house of cards. So that's the one thing that would really destroy ISIS.
Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer is professor of sociology and global and international studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His books include God in the Tumult of the Global Square. His Religion Dispatches article is headlined Why ISIS War Would Make Paris Attacks a Success, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. It's always great to have you on State of Belief Radio, and this time is no exception.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your the conversation.
Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. As powerful as the repercussions of the November 13th terror attacks in Paris have been across this country, just imagine how things have been impacted in France. Now imagine working for interfaith cooperation and understanding at the Western world's latest ground zero. Courageously doing that work is Coexister, the leading interfaith organization in the country. And I'm very pleased to welcome its founder, Samuel Grabowski, to State of Belief Radio. Samuel joins us from Paris, France. Samuel, welcome to State of Belief.
Well, thank you very much.
What is it like on the streets of Paris and other cities in France today?
The mood on the street is really different than after the previous attacks that we had in January or in 2012. We are not really able to explain why the mood is really different, but maybe the feeling of unity, the feeling that we are all united because we are French people, is very different and it is very deep. I mean, that all the people are now deeply sure that we are all the targets of the Daesh. Even if we are Jews or Christians or Muslims or atheists, whatever we can be, whatever we can believe in, we are the target of the same enemy in a way. So maybe this is the reason why people feel very united. And it's very new because, for example, in January, on the few days after the attacks, many Muslims people or Jews people explained that they were the target of threats, of attacks, of criminality. And now, after 5 or 6 days, all the Jews and Muslims that they can make testimony on the media, they say, we feel safe, we feel secure because people would like to protect us. They organize things on Twitter, on Facebook to help people to feel united.
Samuel, tell us a little bit about your work at Coexister and what you do normally.
Okay, basically, Coexister is the interfaith youth movement in France, and we are rooted in 30 different groups in 30 different cities on the country. Each group is based on friendship of 7 people from different faith. Could be Jews, Christians, Muslims, atheists, agnostics, or Buddhists, Hindus. And these 7 people are the leaders of the groups. And each groups are working on the same agenda. And each groups are working on 3 steps of interface cooperation. And these 3 steps are first dialogue every week. Have a roundtable, have a conference, have a debate, have something about conversation. So dialogue every week, action every month, solidarity to make concrete our motto. Our motto is different faith, common actions. Exactly like the Religions for Peace organization, but in French, it's different. So this is solidarity. It's to be able to decide the place, the goal, where we can be united. Because we are not able to be united on the faith. Our faiths are really different, are deeply different. But the concrete fix we can do together make us united. And the third part of this trip of coexistence is raising awareness. So we go in schools every trimester to destroy prejudice, to speak about laïcité, you know, the French secularism, to speak about religious freedom, to speak about anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, or also to speak about religions, because there is no lessons about religions at school in France. So in a way, we do it.
Sammy, you've given us a little bit of information on what members of Coexister do and what you do as the leader. How has all of that changed since last Friday, or has it?
Nothing is changing for us, because this is the third time in France that there is a big attack in the territories in different points. March 2012, January 2015, and now November 2015. So sadly, we know how to resist, because we resisted before on the same way. The big difference is that many, many people were killed, really more than before, because it's 132 people, so it's really more. And the emotion of people, they are really moved. And on this emotion, we are here. We stand up to say we should go from the emotion to the action. And our idea is to do exactly the same, because what we do is the best protection against radicalization. It's the best protection against division, against hatred. So we just would like to continue our work, to keep concentrated, to stay focused on the issue, and to promote that we can be diverse and unite. Because for some people in France, we have to make a choice between unity and diversity. But there is no unity without diversity. Unity without diversity is uniformity. And many people in France would like to promote uniformity. Very concrete example. When we decided in January to say, "Je suis Charlie," you remember, "I am Charlie." When we say that, the country promoted an idea of uniformization, uniformity. We are all the same, but it's wrong. We are not all the same. So in November, we decided to change the motto. We don't say anymore, "I am Charlie" or "Je suis Charlie." We say, "Nous sommes unis." It means we are united. And when we say "we are" instead of "I am," many things change.
Here in the United States, there has been almost what I would call panic in light of what happened in Paris. And we're seeing even high-level politicians just go crazy and favor actions that are contradictory even to our Constitution. Is there a sense of that kind of panic in France?
It's a really good question, because I don't think so, to be honest. I'm sure politicians do something wrong sometimes, but as I have read some things that your leaders said on the past few days, it's really different. There is nothing we can compare with, because except a very, very extreme right. I would like to say it's very sad to share with you that, but what I have read from the extreme right in France, it's really, it's not worse than what I have heard from the United States, from your leaders, especially from the Republican Party. Fortunately, we have a great civil society, very organized, and we were able to make a kind of lobby or advocacy to defend our idea on the field. And politicians are not able to surf on ideas that we don't have in the competition, you know? So because we don't have this idea in the populations, thanks that we don't have this idea in the population, they are not able to surf on it. And the worst thing that I've heard in France is just that the extreme right would like to put in jail people who are following by the security service, you know, by the intelligence. This is 4,000 people. Some of them are Muslims, 17% only. So these 4,000 people, the extreme right would like to bring them to jail. This is the worst thing that I have heard.
Yeah. Samuel, we are getting hour by hour by hour reports on our public media in the United States. You've already given us some new insight through what you've said, but what can you tell us about the situation there What do we need to know about the situation there that we may not be hearing elsewhere?
Yes, I think that you need to know that it is really different from Muslim people first, because for the first time, there is no massive movement against the Muslim guys, because we realized, I think about the French people, we realized that all the victims were from 12 different countries and from all different faiths. And they didn't make selections. There was no selection at all. So they just put their balls from their guns to our generation. All the people who died were under 30 years old. So they just killed our generation. Jews, Christians, Muslim, atheists from 12 different countries, 12 different citizenship. Because they were in Paris for holidays or for a party or for going to a concert. So, and we all know this room, this theater, you know, Bataclan. We've been all to this place to have a night or a party. So for us, we feel that our generation was the target. So we feel very united about it. And I hope that in all countries over the world, they understand that the goal of Daesh is to divide us, to make people, to kill people is just maybe 20% of the plan. 80% of the plan is to divide countries, is to provoke, is to promote a civil war, because what they are looking for is to provoke that politicians stigmatize Muslims people. Yeah. And Muslims people become angry, and Muslim people kill other people, and civil war began. This is 80% of the plan, and this plan is written. It is written on a book with 2,050 pages by the man in charge of the ideology of Daesh. So 80% of the plan depends on us. 80% of the plan depends on our unity. And for now, in France, we feel it deeply. We deeply feel it in our movement. We are from all different faiths, but in the streets, in the terrace, in the restaurant, in the cafe, we feel that we are all the target of Daesh, and we try to make the relations deeper than before.
Samuel, one last question to contrast what you've just said about the vision of ISIS. What is your vision for your work in France?
What is my vision?
What is your vision?
Okay, my vision is that for the 3 next weeks, we have to continue our efforts on concrete and simple actions that people can spread on Twitter. For example, just ring your neighbors, just invite him for a coffee time, and just exchange and speak about the situation. Or for example, just organize a safe space to exchange for one hour in a coffee to speak about the situation. Many concrete things that we can do just for 3 weeks, because these things are not sufficient. They are necessary, but they are not sufficient. We need to do more. We need to organize a very big partnership between the states and the civil society. And if we dispatch the responsibility, for example, the state is in charge of our security, the state is in charge of the war in Syria. The civil society could be in charge of education, of popular education, of informal education, like Scoutism or different movements. The civil society could be in charge of struggles against prejudice, of social cohesion. And if we receive means to do that, for money, funds, support, etc., we can build this partnership of between civil society and state. And after that, we will be able to live all together.
I've been talking with Samuel Grabowski, who runs the leading interfaith organization in France. It's called Coexister. Samuel, I know these are hectic days and very busy days, and I can't express enough my appreciation for you taking time to join us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we go, I have some words to share with you. when I do commentaries on State of Belief, I like them to be well-worded, succinct, sharp. But today, I want to speak to you just off the cuff, because I'm confused as well as concerned. I see major values in our nation in conflict with each other. And at moments, it seems like reason has just been tossed out the window. I know fear. I remember 9/11 when the symbols of freedom in D.C. were heavily guarded and protected by large concrete barriers. I remember the sound of planes circling in the skies. Police officers were prolific. And then came a period of emphasis on killing with the two snipers that were haunting our city and also the area around. Tension mounted every day. But never have I felt the kind of fear that I have felt this week, that has grown more intense with every hyperbolic statement made by leaders who seem to have forgotten the essence of the American spirit and the Constitution that protects it. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I have hurt for France. I know the danger of ISIS and their commitment to evil and destruction. I do support a rethinking of the administration's strategy. I think that we ought to be dealing with a coalition of the world as we talk about that. Violence may be needed, but never violence alone. I understand all that. But advocating saving only Americans as we think of refugees from Syria? Come on, folks. Talking about roundups of immigrants in America to deport them? And even mentioning a recurrence of the mass incarceration of the Japanese people? Have we not learned anything? Good God, what are people thinking? And the Christians calling for favoritism for other Christians seem to be the most violently oriented in their thoughts. And it makes me ask the question, who is a Christian? But I also ask, who is an American? How cheap is democracy for those people who want to build a fence around our nation and shut out the world as if we're the only ones that need to live? Do they not know that their words betray their lack of courage for protecting democracy, not their sick ideology? I see the challenge of ISIS. I know that. I know that is uppermost in people's minds, and I understand that to an extent, but keep thinking. I don't understand the panic about immigration and the level of enthusiasm of hawks that want to place our men and women of the military in the killing fields abroad as quickly as they can. You've just heard on this show, we're playing into the hands of ISIS. We're doing what they want us to do. Terrorism is working. Even several candidates for the presidency are demonstrating irrationality and their lack of patience and reason, qualities that are needed, quick anger and denial and degradation for other people, all indicators of individuals who don't have what it takes to be president of this nation. Our values as Americans, the values in the Constitution, hospitality to immigrants, freedom for all citizens, no religious test in order to experience democracy, justice on the basis of trials by jury, are for the most difficult moments in our lives, not just for the good, easy moments in our lives. In the earliest days after 9/11, President George W. Bush went to a mosque in D.C. as a symbol that said, we're not in conflict with any religion. We're not about a conflict of civilizations. We're only concerned with people who want to take away our religion. It was the thoughtful, fitting thing to do. And it was done quietly, not in anger, not in anger, not shouting. I appreciate President Obama's patience and reasoned responses to wild rhetorical forays into narrow-minded exclusivism and anti-American forms of hatred. Those who continue to call for a clash of civilizations are simply forwarding the message that ISIS wants us to hear. It's Thanksgiving week. For Thanksgiving this year, and I hope you have a good one, tears are in my eyes, and fear is in my heart. My prayers are not only about gratitude. They pulsate with profound hope that the screams with which some of our citizens are shouting down freedom and once again applauding religious discrimination will realize that their attitudes and expressions of it are far more like the attitudes and rhetoric of those people abroad that they seek to silence forever. God help us. Have a great Thanksgiving. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say thank you for it. We really rely on listener support to keep this show on the air. As the end of the year gets closer, please consider a tax-deductible contribution to State of Belief and to Interfaith Alliance. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to friends or acquaintances, please share it with them. It's very easy to do on Facebook, Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from that crazy intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. No, I really mean it. You all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.